from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome to episode 62. Well, what a show we have today, hey? We're back on tour. Well, we can't leave home. So let's imagine we've moved from Berlin a couple of weeks ago to Indianapolis, home of the famous friend of 30 Laps, the Brickyard, but we're not stopping there. And from there down south to an appalling tourist attraction in Louisiana. All will be revealed this week. We'll hear about bear cats. Not any old bear cat, a Stutz bear cat, to be precise. And after we hear about it, you and me and the ghost of Elvis, yep, that Elvis, will take in the Whitney Plantation on the banks of the Mississippi. We're all a hootin' and a hollerin' this week on 30 Laps. So what's a bear cat, I hear you ask? Well, 30 Laps is going to tell you. And this comes from Wikipedia. The Stutz Motor Car Company of America, Incorporated, was an American producer of high-end sports and luxury cars based in Indianapolis, Indiana. Production began in 1911 and ended in 1935. The brand reappeared in 1968, under the aegis of the Stutz Motor Car of America Incorporated, and was newly defined with a modern retro look. Although the company is still technically in existence, sales of factory-produced vehicles ceased in 1995. Throughout its history, Stutz was known as a producer of fast cars, America's first sports car, and, from 1924, luxury cars for the rich and famous. The Ideal Motor Car Company, organised in June 1911 by Harry C. Stutz with his friend Henry F. Campbell, they love those middle initials, don't they, began building Stutz cars in Indianapolis in the same year. They set this business up after a car built by Stutz in under 5 weeks and entered in the name of his Stutz Auto Parts Company was placed 11th in the Indianapolis 500, earning it the slogan, "The car that made good in a day." Ideal built what amounted to copies of the race car, which added fenders and lights, and sold them with the model Stutz Bearcat, Bearcat being the name of the actual race car. The Bearcat featured a 389 cubic inch Wisconsin brawny four-cylinder T-head engine with four valves per cylinder, one of the earliest multi-valve engines, matched with one of Harry Stutz's transaxles. Stutz Motor had also been credited with the development of the underslung chassis, an invention that greatly enhanced the safety and cornering of motor vehicles, and one that is still in use today. Stutz White Squadron race team won the 1913 and the 1915 national championships before withdrawing from racing in October 1915. In June 1913, the Ideal Motor Company changed its name to Stutz Motor Car Company of Indiana and Stutz Auto Parts Company. It manufactured that axle we were talking about, the transaxle axle, actually the transaxle, and was merged into both companies. To find a new investment capital for expansion, Stutz Motor Car Company of Indiana was sold in 1916 to Stutz Motor Car Company of America under an agreement with a consortium to list the specially organized holding company stock on the New York Stock Exchange. Harry Stutz left Stutz Motors on July 1, 1919, and went off with Henry Campbell to establish his HCS Motor Car Company and the Stutz Fire Apparatus Company. Alan Aloysius Ryan, father of Alan A. Ryan Jr., was left in control of Stutz Motor Car Company. Ryan Sr. and friends attempted a stock manipulation, which in April 1920 proved disastrous. Stutz Motor Company was delisted. The Stutz Motor Company was the last publicly detected international corner of the New York Stock Exchange. Ryan Sr. was bankrupted in August 1922 and disinherited by his father, Thomas Fortune Ryan. There were 500 of them, I think. Anyway, meanwhile, two friends of Thomas Fortune Ryan found themselves with large parcels of Stutz stock. Charles Michael Schwab, Eugene van der Ressler, Thayer, and president of Chase National Bank. The new owners brought in Frederick Ewan Moskowitz. And Moskowitz quickly as well refocused the company as a developer of safety cars, a recurring theme in the auto industry. In the case of Stutz, the car featured safety glass, a low centre of gravity for better handling, and hill-holding transmission called No Back. One notable advance was the 1931 double overhead cam 32 valve inline 8 called the DV32, DV being short for dual valve. This was during the so-called cylinders race of the early 1930s, when makers of some of the most expensive cars were rushing to produce multi-cylinder engines. Stutz Motors did not go for the V12 and V16 engines, but instead stayed true to its performance heritage with the dual overhead cam inline 8 design as used on the sporting cars of the era, or even the era, such as Bugatti, Alfa, Duesenberg and Miller. Brochures boasted 100 plus miles per hour the following year. In that year, a 4.9-litre 300-inch Stutz, entered and owned by wealthy French pilot and inventor Charles Wyman, in the hands of Robert Bloch and Edouard Brisson, finished second at the 24 Hours of Le Mans, losing to the 4.5-litre model, Bentley of Rubin and Bonato, despite losing Top Gear 90 minutes from the flag, the best result for an American until 1966. You remember that, folks, 1966. We did a whole program on that race. That same year, developed engineer and racing driver Frank Lockhart used a pair of supercharged 91-inch double overhead cam engines in his Stutz Blackhawk Special, while Stutz set another speed record at Daytona Beach, reaching 106.53 miles per hour. And which made it the fastest production car in America. Stutz Motor Company acquired the manufacturing rights for the Pack Age car, a light delivery vehicle that they had been distributing since 1927. 15 new Stutz models were introduced at the 1932 New York Motor Show by Charles Schwab, including the Pack Age car. The delivery vehicle was put into production by Stutz's package car division in March 1933, and the production of the automobiles stopped. When production ended in 1935, 35,000 had been manufactured. Stutz Motors was hit by a stock manipulation again in 1935, but without the spectacular numbers of 1920. Stutz filed for bankruptcy in 1937, and though its assets exceeded its liabilities, creditors were unable to agree on a plan for the revival. And in April 1939, the court ordered its liquidation. The former Indianapolis factory is today known as the Stutz Business Center and is home to more than 80 artists, sculptors, photographers, designers, architects, and craftsmen. Some famous owners. Blackhawks, Bag Hats, Royal Limousines, Five Port and Victorias. Elvis Presley bought the first Blackhawk in 1971 and later purchased a further three. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Evel Knievel, Barry White and Sammy Davis Jr. all own Stutz cars. The Stutz Blackhawk, owned by Lucille Ball, was for a time on display at the Imperial Palace Hotel and Casino at the Auto Collection in Las Vegas. However, owing to their extraordinary cost, Stutz Stutz was touted as the world's most expensive car, a Royal limousine costing US $285,000, and a Black Hawk coupe over $115,000 in 1984. At the same time, a Ferrari 288 GTO was only $85,000 at the time. Production was very limited, and it's believed only 617 cars were built during the company's first 25 years of existence. It's 1971 to 1995. Sales of Stutz began to wane in 1985 and continued to do so until 1995. Warren Liu became its main shareholder and took over ownership of Stutz Motor Car Company of America in 1982. Just a quick one in some popular culture. In the Happy Days episode, In the Name of Love, Howard Cunningham tells his son Richie how Marion was in love with a man that drove a Stutz Bearcat and wore a raccoon skin coat before they were married. On The Simpsons, Mr. Burns owns a 1936 Stutz Bearcat, and he, Homer Simpson and Smithers used the car to get away from the FBI when they committed treason in the episode, The Trouble with Trillions. Today, Stutz are very rare, and very few were produced and are known to sell well over 100,000 worldwide through private collections and auction, if you're lucky enough to get your hands on one.
Got to blow the fuel, man. We got to do it.
Yeah, well, I bet there were a few fuses blown in a Stutz Bearcat. And that music? Well, we are heading down south after all. I'm sure Sonny and Terry will join us a bit later on. And let's go to American Classics Culture European Oddities, online edition, January 30, 2017, by Jim Mottiavelli. A mostly new 1988 Stutz Bearcat 2 with Elvis heritage. Let's get straight away to that Stutz Bearcat 2, like the one currently on eBay. Has absolutely nothing in common with the original, which debuted in 1912. Stutz was a very prestigious automaker on its day, and the racy Bearcat helped make its name. Essentially a racer for the road, the original Bearcat had a minimal bodywork and a mighty 390 cubic inch four that produced 60 horsepower, which was a lot for that day. The Bearcat was called the car that made good in a day, since it went well 11th place, as we said, in the 1911 Indianapolis. Then there was the hand-tooled Stutz Black Hawk Coupe. The iteration sat on a powerful 425 horsepower Pontiac Grand Prix chassis, and it was the first to appear. In 1970, Frank Sinatra was interested in buying the prototype, but it was Elvis Presley who actually took delivery. Elvis's car was sent to customizer George Barris for further personalization, and then Elvis added it to his fleet. He loved the car and used it frequently, at least until an accident, without Elvis aboard, in 1971. The restored car can now be seen at Graceland's. Stutz also built such exotics as the 25-foot long armoured Stutz Royal limousine, with a name borrowed from Bugatti. These were offered at $550,000, making the US record Guinness record book as the most expensive automobile at that time. Some found a home in the Middle East. Another fast escape vehicle was the Chevy Suburban, based on the bulletproof all-terrain Griselle, later known as the Defender, with a machine gun as an added deterrent. And it's the Stutz Black Hawk Coupe today that we are driving down from Indianapolis to the banks of the Mississippi in Louisiana to have a look at our tourist attraction, in inverted commas. This was written by Lance Richardson on January 13 of this year, 2020, and it comes from the executive travel section of the Fairfax Media. The remarkable house at Whitney Plantation stands on the banks of the Mississippi River. Leading up to it are two rows of live oaks dripping with Spanish moss, which creates a natural tunnel and a picturesque frame as we drive in our Stutz down the driveway. The big house is at the end of the tunnel, French Creole style, with two white column floors and a wide veranda. As habitations go, it's grand and majestic, but it is also, when you look closer, completely appalling. Like many places in Louisiana, the Whitney was built on the backs of enslaved people. This is one of the many things I learn on a walk around the plantation. The more than 12 million Africans who were stolen from their homelands and carried across the ocean to America were not slaves, but enslaved people. The subtle shift is important. Slavery was not who they were. It was a condition forcibly inflicted upon them by others here in this alien place. We arrive at the Whitney, which is open to the public by guided tour only on a steamy Thursday afternoon. A small group of us pick up umbrellas, the sun is blazing, and follow a man called Ali onto the grounds. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice, Montgomery, Alabama. "We don't expect anyone to come as an expert on slavery," he says with a thick Louisiana accent. "Don't learn enough about it in our school system for that." For almost 2 hours, Ali explains how black bodies transformed an inhospitable swamp into productive sugarcane fields. It was the deadliest form of farming in the world, and the average life expectancy was just 10 years. "Come on, 10 years," Ali says, "dead when 20. He is a direct and unsparing of his descriptions of an economic model that reduced human beings to the status of a chattel. The Whitney is fascinating, often shocking. Bodies have been exhumed here with the tendons worked out of their joints through brute, hard labour. But for me, it's background, and it's just part of the story, shocking though it may be. Slavery was abolished in America in 1865 when Congress finally ratified the 13th Amendment. Still, people tend to be disinclined to give up prejudice just because the federal government tells them they're wrong. In the South, in the first 2 years after the American Civil War, thousands of African Americans were murdered for exerting their newly won rights. These murders, sometimes called racial terror lynchings, then continued for decades as a new social hierarchy was constructed based on ideas of segregation and white supremacy. In other words, the slavery seen at the Whitney Plantation did not fully disappear. It simply evolved into something else. That something else and the racial terror lynchings are the focus of a poignant memorial which opened last year in Alabama. Leaving the Whitney and Louisiana, I drive northeast in the Stutz for 5 hours through bayou and forest. Eventually I reach Montgomery, a town famously associated with the modern civil rights movement. Here is where Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a bus for a white man in 1955. Here is where a young reverend named Martin Luther King Jr. organized a bus boycott which led the Supreme Court to demand integration and thrust King onto the national stage. The National Memorial for Peace and Justice sits in the center of Montgomery, high on a green hillock. It was created by Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, a non-profit which provides legal services to incarcerated people who can't afford a lawyer. They have more work than they can handle. The memorial is based on years of research and public archives by Stevenson's staff. Years of research that uncovered evidence of almost 4,400 lynchings perpetrated by groups of 2 to over 10,000 white people. Approaching the hill is to be confronted almost immediately with a breathtaking sight. On the ascending pathway, I pause, as do a crowd of school children, in front of Africans in chains. There are shackles around their necks and their faces are contorted in confused misery. The Ghanaian artist who made these graphic statues, Guillaume Akobo Bamfo, has no interest in consoling. He means to shake you awake. The rest of the memorial may be less visually abrupt, but it disturbs me no less for its symbolic implications. At the top of the hill is a square cloister, which begins at ground level and then spirals down to the earth. On the walkway are 800 steel columns, each one engraved with the names of lynching victims from various counties, including the one where the Whitney is located. As I walk down the spiral, the columns remain fixed in place, so I must increasingly crane my neck upwards to make out the names. Eventually, like a punch to the gut, I realise that the columns are dangling overhead. As Billie Holiday once sang, "Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the polar trees." Through the power of creative architecture, the memorial makes a visitor a witness. It does this at the same moment it is confronting you with an incomprehensible stories etched into the walls. Frank Dodd, was lynched in DeWitt, Arkansas in 1916 for annoying a white woman. Mary Turner, meanwhile, was lynched with her unborn child at Folsom Bridge in the Brooks-Lowndes County line in George in 1918 for complaining about the recent lynching of her husband, Hayes Turner. As I emerge back into the sunlight, the true purpose of the National Memorial for Peace and Justice becomes clear. In a memorial park, replicas of the 800 steel columns are lined up waiting to be collected. Beginning next year, each county will have an opportunity to acknowledge and confront its own complicity in this historical violence. What the Equal Justice Initiative has created is a stunning monument meant to trigger a national conversation, or a national reckoning. A need for this reckoning is only reinforced at an accompanying legacy museum, which brings the story up to date. Slavery is over. Jim Crow is over, lynchings are over, but is prejudice over? The museum argues no. It illustrates ways in which the American criminal justice system is tainted by an implicit bias that disproportionately targets people of colour. Whether police brutally or unequally incarceration rates, 1 in 3 black baby boys is expected to go to jail or prison, a plaque claims the evidence is troubling. As I walk around, one image stops me cold. Incarcerated men are forced to labour in the fields of the Louisiana State Penitentiary, formerly a slave plantation. The caption reads, and the photograph shows a line of black men being directed by a white man on a horse. It could have been taken at Whitney, and yet it was taken in 2011.
Working out here on this old tin gang. Gonna do every kind of work in the world, and the worst kind of weather in the world, looks like. Trying to pick a bale of cotton long in the early winter time. Wear out 3 or 4 pair of gloves every day, stripping on those stalks. Putting everything in your cotton sack with sand, rocks, roots, stumps, anything in the way up them scales. So you pick a bale of cotton off the land of things. Don't care how.
Whoa, Lordy. Whoa, Lordy. Whoa, Lordy. Whoa, Lordy. You want to jump down, turn around. You want to jump down, turn around.
Yeah, well, I did tell you they'd be back, didn't I? I guess the music is one of the positive things about that period of history. The Whitney Plantation in Wallace, Louisiana, is an easy 1-hour drive west from New Orleans. Montgomery, Alabama, is a 5-hour drive northeast from New Orleans, or just 2 hours south from Atlanta, which is the major transport hub for Delta Airlines. That was brought to you by Lance Richardson, and he's a travel writer for the Murdoch Media. So we're getting our stuts and we get the heck out of there, and we drive back towards Indianapolis, with the ghost of Elvis Presley in the back. And there's no music from Elvis today, because we had music from Elvis just a couple of weeks ago, but I can assure you his dulcet tones will be heard again on this program. And from the piece that we missed out last week, let's finish with this, from Andrew Slice, driven.co.nz, the name's Martin, Aston Martin, doesn't quite have the same ring, does it? But that didn't stop a presumably James Bond fan and car enthusiast from paying megabucks for a priceless piece of the franchise's history. Used in the iconic 1964 film Goldfinger, this Aston Martin DB5 is one of the four cars that were built for the movie's production and looks as if it rolled out of the MI6 factory just yesterday. Predicted to fetch between $6 and $9 million, this pristine DB5 exceeded these expectations and sold for a whopping $9.8 million. The price puts it well ahead of the previous DB5 that set a price of $6.5 million in 2010. As this model was used in the movie, it features all of Bond's gadgets that he used to fight the baddies. This means that the retractable bulletproof screen is there, an ejector seat, an in-dash radar, hidden machine guns, an oil slick sprayer. They're all in there. All the gadgets are fully functional, apart from the machine guns that only produce a sound, but using them on public roads isn't advised. In the lead-up to the auction, Ruse Engineering in Switzerland completed a full restoration on the DB5 that took 4 years. This workshop is one of 13 facilities that Aston Martin has appointed as heritage specialists. Despite the fact that this DB was built for the movie, it never actually featured on screen at any point, but instead was used for promotional work for Thunderball. While it's road legal, it's going to be interesting to see how the new owners decides to drive it, considering its worth and the fact that its value will probably appreciate over the next 3 years. 9.8 million. Hey, whew, that's a lot of money. Thank you, Andrew Slice from driven.co.nz. I hope you enjoyed the show today. It was a bit sobering, I must admit, in parts, but I thought it was an interesting article that is worth remembering and in some ways never forgetting those troubles they had in the early to mid-1800s in the United States. They essentially fought a war over it, after all, that lasted for 3 years. But anyway, we had a wonderful drive in our Stutz and with the ghost of Elvis. And I hope you enjoyed that. And we also had a look at the original Aston Martin DB5 that never made it for the movie it was designed for, but in fact made it to help sell Thunderball. And of course, the history of the Stutz Bearcat 2, another American motor car company that went big and then blew up, and the rest is history, as they say. Thank you very much for your company this afternoon. I've enjoyed bringing this to you. Richard Lyon, 30 Laps with Dick. See you next, or talk to you, hopefully, next week.